What is it that happened in Stuart Davis's life that has him at this point of a successful career writing about aliens and ghosts and doppelgangers? We're going to get into that a little bit. We have already tried to crack the Voynich code. From here on out, in our final hour, we'll try to track the code of what makes Stuart Davis tick. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Stuart Davis, that song, pretty song, by the way, they're already here. They being what, aliens?
Oh, good question. What I would say is that there are layers of responding to that question, and definitely one of the layers is aliens. I might put it in quotes just because my own sense of what is alien and what might be behind it has developed and remained dynamic over the last 10 years or so. But yes, definitely the immediate layer of that song is the alien phenomena, and whether that's abduction or UFOs, the history of that entire world has always captivated me. And that song is just the latest iteration of my process of metabolizing that mystery.
And have you had an encounter, perhaps in the physical realm or perhaps in some kind of other state, an encounter with what you might call an alien or an other?
Well, my response to that question is I don't have the concrete experience of most abductees. I have no, like, I didn't, have a UFO encounter, no Travis Walton kind of thing. So my life is not in that category. My experience with the enigma is more in the shamanistic dimension of my own art. My life is a spiritual practitioner and a meditation practitioner. I have had some experiences in altered states. Very interestingly to me, one of the main alien, quote unquote, event of my life occurred in a fever dream. And as a little bit of a backstory, I've long been fascinated with fevers, high fevers as an altered state. And so for some reason, when I was a kid, I had a lot of high fevers. And for years, I encountered frequent bouts with them. And while that was going on, I became interested in them because I was having this kind of deja vu every time I would have a high fever in that altered state. I remembered this acquaintance with a kind of faculty that I didn't have when I was not with fever, strangely. So the backstory is that I became unusually interested in trying to cultivate high fevers for whatever riches they might offer or whatever there might be to explore there. So later in life, when I had a high fever on New Year's, like this was years ago, I asked to speak with my guide because one of the pieces of information and communication that I have received from my spiritual guides, be they real or an aspect of myself, one of the communications that I've had is that I should seek direct one-to-one communication and not rely upon intermediaries because the message and the signals get confused. So I asked for a direct one-to-one with whoever my alien representative was when I was in this high fever state, and this massive 8-foot-tall praying mantis manifest in my room over my bed and emitted this series of clicks and kind of a synthetic hybridization of technological clicks and pops along with an organic language of some kind. All of it was completely unintelligible to me intellectually, but there was a transmission occurring of some kind. That is probably the most explicit one-to-one I've had with some kind of personification of an alien intelligence. In my normal day-to-day life outside of fevers, I had a long friendship with John Mack. I have many friends, many close acquaintances who are alien abductees. So I've moved in that world in a very personal way. And before John passed away, I actually did work with him and had a lot of one-to-one time with him. And I personally feel very intimately connected to the puzzle of this entire thing. I think that it's linked somehow into our development as human beings. I think that there certainly is a concrete physical, corporeal dimension to it, but that is the curtain. And what's really compelling and interesting to me is what's behind the curtain, the reality behind these appearances. And to bring it back in an interesting way to the Voynich manuscript and constructed languages and art, to me, there's definitely a signaling system that is in play here. And it's been signaling for centuries or millennia. And that's the really interesting part, because I feel like there's some kind of system of decoys, and that this puzzle morphs and shifts along with our human development. It always seems to find a register or a bandwidth that's just beyond the event horizon of our collective center of gravity developmentally. And I love that. And when I found Jacques Vallée's work, this whole thing started to come together for me in a way that it hadn't before. So John Mack and Jacques Vallée are the two folks that I would say have figured most prominently. But the way that I have expressed it and explored it chiefly has been through music, and that song is an example of that.
Well, I think it's smart of you to not lock yourself in any particular position on what aliens might be, whether they're space aliens. A lot of people think they're extraterrestrials or interdimensionals or time travelers or ultra-terrestrials or any number of other kinds of exotic explanations. The fact is, we simply don't know. We just know there's something else going on. You also expressed your opinion in sort of it's almost like a comedy monologue, but pretty interesting. I thought we would play a little bit of that and share it with our audience. I think they'll get a kick out of it. Nathan, if you would.
I'm coming out of the cosmic closet. I'm not actually a person. I'm an alien. Or at least I was before I started showing off. Hey, look what I can do. I can become human. I come from a long line of cosmic gypsies. We find exotic hotspots in the universe and then mingle with the locals. We literally incarnate as different forms of life for giggles. A long time ago, in a dimension far away, my friend had just returned from a place called Earth, and he couldn't stop raving. "Dude, you gotta go," he telepathied. "You have not been dumpster diving until you've crawled into the body of a person on Earth. Being a person is the wildest ride in the universe." "Why?" I telepathied. "Because a person comes out of another person. The only way into Earth is out of a woman person. Just when you get used to living inside a woman, the woman you live in ejects you from one of the many holes a person has. Pow! The lights hit your visual receptors. Oh, dude, the lights. You will be squinting for weeks. The only thing more intense than the lights on Earth is the volume. Everything is loud. Voices, communication devices, transportation pods. Even the weather is loud. It's like somebody turned down the planet." "Why is it so loud?" I telepathy whispered. "Because humans have no telepathy," he telepathied. "A person communicates by emitting audio signals called sound. They arrange sounds into signifiers. It's archaic. They've got the whole planet turned up to 10. "Shut up. Serious. That's bizarre," I telepathied. "But you know what was my favorite thing about being a person on Earth? You forget your God. Get out. Seriously. I am becomes I amnesia. So you go search for yourself in other people. And that is called looking for love." "What's love like?" "You just gotta experience it for yourself. Hearing that made me want to go to Earth and become a person. So I watched and I waited for my chance. One night, I made my move. I dove into the woman's belly. 9 months later, I was expelled. I emerged at the cosmic nexus known as Des Moines, Iowa. Now, I'm a person. People of Earth, I am here to learn what love is. Will you show me?"
That's a lot of fun. And, you know, I've heard the skeptics, the debunkers say, you know, why would aliens come here if they're space aliens or time travelers? Why would they bother with us? Well, we're pretty darn interesting. I think that was a fun way to describe it, that humans could be pretty darn fascinating for somebody from another culture, another place.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of all of the places that you could be in the cosmos and all of the kinds of entities that you could incarnate as. I certainly think there's something incredibly compelling and magnetic about this planet. So that, yeah, I love that you played that, by the way. Thank you for playing that. That's called Becoming Human, and it's on my website, stuartdavis.com. And it's just, you know, it's telling the artistic truth. I think that is my best guess for, you know, what could be a plausible story of how incarnation transpires and what makes us want to do it. That's probably my good a guess as any for me.
So I had asked you about any kind of alien encounter. You also write about secret societies, the apocalypse, things of that sort. These are you a coast listener? Or are this the kind of topics that have been creeping into your consciousness for a while?
Definitely. Are you kidding me? I've been keeping it cool, but I'm a long time coast fanatic. So yeah, this is like the Beatles of radio shows for me to be on. And it's a funny story. You know, when I started touring in the United States, I spent a decade driving around. My shows would always wrap up at 10 or 11 at night, and then I would have to drive to the next town. And I was doing 150 shows a year all over the U.S. So every night when I would get in my vehicle to make it to the next town, Coast would just be starting up, and I would spend the drive listening to the show. So it factored prominently in the influence of what my interests are, and also in a dovetail fit with it. I've always been drawn toward the paranormal and the esoteric. And as a spiritual practitioner, you know, this stuff all fits together for me in a way. You may initially feel like, you know, there's something incongruent with an interest in aliens and, you know, Zen meditation and the shamanic dimension of art. But for me, I mean, it's all neatly woven together in a way that we can't immediately make sense of it all. But if you spend time in a non-intellectual, you know, non-cerebral relationship with it, there is this very creative component to the way that these decoys operate on our awareness. You know, one of the things that I immediately learned as a meditation practitioner, the kind of meditation that I practice, makes the subject of your awareness become an object in your awareness. So you basically look at the contents of your mind like they are a mobile of objects. And then your subject moves into this seat where it kind of watches and witnesses everything. And what's interesting about that psychologically is that that process of making your subject an object in your awareness has been demonstrated to accelerate and assist with human development and assist with our growth. And when I started to read about UFOs and I became friends with John Mack, who was, as you know, probably was a psychiatry professor at Harvard, and then reading Jacques Vallée, I noticed that the, you know, one of the things we know about these unidentified flying objects is that these objects really have a profound effect on the subjects that witness them. And so these two things lined up in my head, and I thought, that's really interesting. I'm making an object of my subject in meditation, and then these objects that I'm interested in are hovering and are witnessed by the subjects on Earth. And so a link between UFOs and that phenomena with meditation formed for me, and I remain really curious about that. But yeah, to me, that's really, that's the good stuff. That's where art began, you know, whether it was 100,000 or 200,000 years ago or a million years ago, when somebody initially depicted a symbol on a cave wall or, you know, formed a glyph in the sand for the first time. That initial impulse to externalize and express and symbolize our human experience, I think that remains the big code. You know, that's why it's still interesting.
Yeah, you're not the first guy to be moved by the works of Dr. John Mack and Jacques Vallée. Those are the two guys that have been guideposts for me as well and for millions of other people. Let's take some phone calls. We'll go, first of all, to Mark in Asheville, North Carolina, on the Wildcard Line. Hi, Mark.
Hey, George and Stuart, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Quick question. I tuned in a little bit late tonight, but I had heard something in the past about information theory and how the language of dolphins and the language of humans, when plotted by the frequency of the words used on a graph, make an exact 45-degree graph. And according to the theory, any language on earth does the same thing. You plot the frequency of the words used on a graph, and it makes a perfect 45-degree line. And I was wondering if you had applied that at all to the manuscript.
Well, that's really interesting. Not an association that I had made before, and I actually don't know about that study, but I think dolphins are definitely an interesting candidate for a potential linguistic facet to intelligence. That, you know, I'm definitely not an expert in dolphins, but I personally think with the triune brain and the richness of the expressive capacity that they demonstrate, we should be treating them in an entirely different way. So I'm, I have that kind of feeling about dolphins. I don't know enough about their language to make a connection with it to the Voynich manuscript. Do you, George?
I don't. Sorry, Mark, but that probably wouldn't have been a good question for Dr. Stephen Bax, who was our guest earlier. And in fact, you can probably email him, and I think he'd get a kick out of that, or you can go to his website. He welcomes all kinds of input and would probably respond to your question if you gave him a shot. Thanks, Mark, for the call. We're going to try another call east of the Rockies, Marion in St. Louis. Hi, Marion.
Hello. Good morning, and really great program. Enjoying it very much. My thinking about that manuscript, I'm wondering if it's an expansion on the Song of Solomon, maybe written in Hebrew, Aramaic, and a combination of Arabic.
Stuart, any thoughts?
What is it about the manuscript that makes you wonder that?
Well, when they were talking about the beautiful scenes and the young women and everything, I suddenly thought of Song of Solomon. And, you know, when you said it didn't sell well in the early 1900s, you know, they were coming off the gay 90s at that time, the kind of a rowdy period, and everything got kind of prudish, and maybe they thought, well, you know, we can't have a book with these pictures in them. And you know, when you were talking about having a lot of fevers when you were a little boy, I had a lot of fevers when I was growing up because I had bad tonsils, and my doctor didn't want to remove them while my dad was overseas, and I always, before I felt the actual physical being of the fever, I'd have dreams where everything was out of proportion. And it was amazing when you were talking about how you felt when you had those dreams or how I had fevers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that fevers are an undermined resource in terms of altered states. You don't hear them talked about a lot, but I mean, that's just my personal experience was that I wasn't incognizant and rendered undone by the fever. What actually happened was that the veil was lifted on some dimension of my mind and phenomenological aspects of reality that just weren't available to me outside of the fever. So that's why I got interested in it. And I can still remember it when I left. And on the Solomon, the Song of Solomon and the manuscript, I don't know. I haven't heard that association before either. I think the reason that the manuscript didn't sell in the early 1900s is still a mystery to me. And although there was a prudishness taking effect at that time, I don't think that was probably why the manuscript didn't sell.
Yeah, the stuff, Marion, the stuff that's in the manuscript, if you haven't seen it, is not all that racy. I mean, it's got topless women, but it's not written or drawn in some sort of a provocative or sordid sort of a way or in any kind of a porn sort of a way. So I don't think that was it. Thank you for the call, though. Appreciate it. So what's your latest album? What's the deal on that? We got about 30 seconds before we go to the next break.
Well, I'm coming out with a new record very soon called Songbook of the Dead. And it is...
There's a cheery title.
For fans of the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the Coptic right. Book of the Dead or the American Book of the Dead, this is kind of a musical homage.
And the new album that's already out, that's out already?
Music for Mortals, yes, that's out right now, and you can get that just by going to my website, stuartdavis.com or iTunes, and that's completely available everywhere.
Well, we're going to hear one of your other songs right now. I think this is Two Universe Communion. Into the break, hearing Stuart Davis. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We have one segment remaining, and I'll get to as many of your calls as we can here on Coast to Coast AM. By the way, I want to mention any of you are going to be in Las Vegas in the next week. Stanton Friedman, the venerable UFO researcher and author, Stan Friedman, going to be speaking Friday, March 28th at the Atomic Testing Museum. They've been putting on a pretty good lecture series about UFO-type mysteries and got another one coming up. I think the title of the speech is The Real Roswell, but if you've ever seen Stan before, he is one of the most knowledgeable guys, maybe the most knowledgeable guy about the UFO topic in the world, and he can pretty much follow the conversation anywhere it needs to go. So if you're going to be in town Friday, or if you live here, Friday the 28th at the Atomic Testing Museum, check it out. We're talking with Stuart Davis about the Voynich manuscript, UFOs, encounters, all sorts of things. Stuart, you know, we got a lot of musicians, songwriters, talented people like yourself who are interested in these topics. Joe Walsh is a regular listener to the program. Robbie Williams, Tom DeLonge, a friend of the programs who from Blink 182, and they all sort of say the same thing, is that their audiences know about their interest in these topics. For Tom DeLonge, he's written a couple of songs about it, and they sort of expect that he's going to delve into it. Is that how it is for you, that your audiences get it, that they know you're going to be writing about this stuff?
Very much so. I mean, I would say for me, not only is it not a liability or a risk to explore these subjects, my audience is right there with me. We have a mutual fascination and passion for it. I mean, I see it very much as a intrinsic or inherent part of the human experience. And, you know, the available array of what is fascinating and curious about being a person on Earth, these items are squarely in the middle of some of the most interesting stuff. So it'd be crazy to not explore them artistically. And I think also just even as a curious human being, as a subject matter, my audience loves it. And I never have encountered anything that was like, you know, aside from the fact that I will say it's not always welcomed and celebrated by the mainstream music industry in the really conventional sense. You know, I mean, there's been a few instances where my material is definitely too edgy or too off color or too weird, you know, whatever, for X, Y, and Z. But, you know, that is really small potatoes in exchange for what's happened on the other side of things, which is to have a community and to have a shared network of people and relationships. My fans, I would put in quotes, I mean, my relationship with the people who like the music and the art that I make has been very connected, and they've been very involved. So it feels more like a community. But I also wondered if I could just ask you, because I know that you have been in this range of subjects for so long, and in particular with the UFO stuff, I wonder how your opinion or conceptualization of the topic has evolved or morphed over time. Do you feel differently about it now than when you first started the investigative breakthroughs that you were having initially?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, because in those days, we were just looking at it strictly as a flying saucers from other planets coming here visiting, you know, and then there's a steep learning curve for the UFO topic in particular. And the explanation of people from other planets coming here visiting, as Jacques Vallée told me in the early going, if it turns out that the answer to the UFO mystery is simply that people get in spaceships and come and visit our planet, he's going to be sorely disappointed, because he thinks that the evidence, the experiences that humans have had over the centuries, points to something much larger, much grander. And I certainly agree. It's that explanation simply doesn't fit the evidence. And my own interest in the topic has gone far beyond just UFOs to encompass a much broader spectrum of what you'd call paranormal topics. And I think they all fit together. We co-wrote a book about a ranch in Utah, Skinwalker Ranch, and it's been 7-8 years now. And that experience in investigating that stuff changed my viewpoint radically, because it sort of indicated on a very direct and physical way that there is a connection between these other topics. I don't exactly know what the connection is, but it was almost screaming at us that the world is much more complicated, much more wondrous, much more beautiful than we can imagine. And I'm glad that it's led to other things. You know, Jacques Vallée, John Mack, those guys that we both admire, they have hinted to that as well. I mean, not hinted at it, they practically came out and said it. in their works, and I am thankful for that. I just wonder, you know, I mentioned the names of those entertainers, whether it goes hand in hand for people in your line of work, that creative people naturally are drawn to these kind of subjects.
The creative people that I affiliate with and that I, you know, find connection with, definitely I believe that's the case. I think there's also another companion piece to the creativity, and these subjects always seeming to connect and find each other. And one of those is sensitivity. I don't mean sensitivity in the kind of smarmy way or whatever, but as you open yourself to these subjects, and if you're interested in conducting practices that will shift or change your own awareness, and you want to grow as a human being, your sensitivity to the nuances, and as you were describing the wonders of all of these subjects, that increases, and it increases in every direction. So what's difficult about it becomes more difficult and more painful, and what's beautiful about it becomes more beautiful and wonderful. And I think that artists very often experience this kind of expanding of the sphere of their being in all directions simultaneously. So I would say that, yeah, the artistic community that I love and know from all these different genres finds an immediate and unblocked access to the sensitivity of these subjects very easily, yes.
To the calls, callers, west of the Rockies, Jeff in Culver City. Good morning, Jeff. What's on your mind?
George and Mr. Davis, yes, in a way, the Voynich manuscripts are pretty much like Nostradamus' quatrains. Even if the language or code could be deciphered, its true meaning would be debated and critiqued by critics, skeptics, researchers, and experts for years to come. But my question is this, Mr. Davis. Given the fact that we now have many prying eyes in our personal and private affairs by agencies, corporations, and plain nosy people, don't you think that encryption, coded linguistics, deliberate disinformation, and flat-out lies are just a few of the ways to thwart or throw off those who are breaching or compromising our privacy, whether it be written manuscripts, telephonic or electronic communications? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks, Jeff.
Jeff, okay, cool and interesting question. For me, I think that there's, again, I like to qualify my responses by acknowledging the fact that there are layers to what comes up for me in thinking of that question. Number one, yeah, with the prying eyes and the loss of privacy and the invasion of our personal material and professional that's going on, definitely a huge dark weather front that's moving over the interior landscape of humanity right now. But personally for me, I don't feel like more secrecy and encryption and creating ciphers, whether it's linguistic or technological through coding and computers. You know, I think the real long-term solution for humanity, the long-term response to the deep issues that we face, is letting go and releasing the contraction that is veiling each other and ourselves and our communications, whether it's the black budget stuff in the secret world or Dolan's breakaway civilization. I think if we look ahead 1,000 years from now, and we hope to live on a planet where this stuff has been put behind us or has started to recede, I think that transparency and, you know, I'm going to say it, love, love and transparency and the willingness to expose ourselves to each other and become vulnerable and find a new way of trusting. Now, I know that's an ambitious, that's why I say 1,000 years. I know that that's centuries and centuries of inner work for us to do, but I think that's the long game. And I don't, you know, I don't look out 10,000 years and see that the secret subterranean world, literally and metaphorically, will have a long-term game for the human condition, because I just don't think it's a winning game for any of us. It's kind of gone nuts already at this point. I mean, we may be seeing, what do you think about that, George?
I don't even want to get into it, because I'm not optimistic. I'm not optimistic in either the short term or the long term. So, and besides, you're the guest here. We want to hear from you.
Jeff, the guy who's been researching for decades. So, I mean, I think that's a pretty interesting.
Well, one of these days I'll come on your show and you can interview me.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right. First-time caller, Johnny, from right here in Las Vegas. Welcome to the program, Johnny. You're on with Stuart Davis and me.
Well, great. This time, a long-time listener, first-time caller. I've had experience with UFO out by Area 51 myself for the meteor shower August of 2012, around August 12th. This whole cloud was lit up, and there was all kind of rods and circles and triangular craft surrounding it. I've never reported, and I've always felt guilty about that.
Wow, that's a heck of an encounter there. Were there other witnesses? Do you have any photos, video?
One witness that I've known for 20 years, ever since I lived in Minnesota 20 years ago and used to work with at a brewery there. He witnessed it, too. This was a couple hours in the wee hours of when that meteor shower peaks. I go out there every year by the mailbox. I know you frequented that area, too.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been out there, but I'm heading that way soon. But I wonder, Stuart, you can't comment too directly on Johnny's experience, but that's the kind of thing you wish you could see, right? Or not?
Well, you know, what I'll say is that as you were relating that your feeling and relationship to the riddle has evolved over time, I think mine has too. And so I would say that, you know, in the 90s, in the early 90s, yeah, I probably had more of a romantic notion of what an experience would be or an encounter, and maybe I longed for one. And I will say, quite frankly, that my friendship with John Mack and my friendship with abductees and having a personal experience of what they go through and what's involved, I no longer romantically long for any kind of experience in particular. And I think that I'm happy and grateful for my human experience. I'm not averse to having negative experiences if they're towards some growth, etc. But I don't seek out an idea that one of these experiences will produce the change in my consciousness that I need. But I'm very interested in Johnny's call, and I guess my did he hang up the phone, or could he comment on how it changed him?
He's there.
Yeah, Johnny, how did it affect you?
Pardon?
How did the experience affect you since then?
Well, it's made me more obsessed. I never miss a meteor shower in August. I also return in October, November, and December for lesser meteor showers. I really like going out there. I find it fascinating and scary, but at the same time, incredibly exciting. I really am into the whole UFO scene. I got all kinds of tape programs of Mr. Knapp, Mr. Bell, and George Norrie. I'm a real big fan of Coast to Coast. I've even seen you once, George, at the library.
Oh, wow. The library where?
On Flamingo there. You were giving a talk about the Skinwalker Ranch about 5-6 years ago to us.
Right. Well, so it's been a transformative experience for you then in some ways, Johnny?
Very much so, very much so.
And for the positive, for a positive way?
Very much that way, yes, sir.
All right, well, I appreciate you calling, and maybe send me an email at the TV station. I'd like to hear more about your sighting and see if we can correlate it with anybody else who might have had the same experience. Thanks for calling. On the wildcard line, John in Northern Indiana, you have a question for Stuart Davis?
Yeah, George, I would like to get back to the manuscript for a second.
Sure.
I know in 1452, about 600 years ago, the master Leonardo da Vinci was doing his work. And well, he was born in 1452, so I wanted to ask Stuart, did he think that Leonardo da Vinci could have played any part in its creation?
That's a really interesting question. And it is a notion that's been advanced and explored. And I'm not deeply acquainted with all the details, but I believe that that possibility has been ruled out in general because, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, there was like an hour-long television episode devoted to exactly this topic, or mostly, and you can still find that on YouTube if you Google Voynich. So they investigate the Da Vinci connection potentially, and for reasons I can't recall off the top of my head, they kind of rule that out as a good candidate.
Yeah, it's worth asking about, though. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. One of our listeners also mentioned the possibility that Marcus could have been somebody traveling with Marco Polo. And I don't know if the dates coincide, but that would make sense in a way that it's a world traveler, somebody who had been exposed to a whole bunch of different cultures and then incorporated a bunch of them into a language. But It would seem, though, it'd have to be more than just one person, though. It's written for a much larger audience.
That would explain a lot of the variant plant features and the frustration that some folks have had with aligning the plants that are profiled in the manuscript with a particular geographical location. There's a lot of discrepancies with, you know, even the sunflower that they've identified, I don't believe was extant in Europe at the time that the manuscript was. So there's a lot of this stuff with the plants that doesn't quite line up. And what you're describing, George, is one of the better ideas about what may have occurred. Maybe somebody traveling all over the place had cataloged this, you know, nature encyclopedia, and that's why the plants are diverse and not from one geographical location.
Well, one last question for you. We got a couple of minutes left. I'm not sure if you heard Dennis McKenna, who was on the program earlier, or have heard other interviews with him, but of course he has written about plants and the psychoactive power of plants, and I know that you have an interest in achieving higher realms of consciousness or existence. Dennis McKenna, of course, believes that you can encounter beings while you're under the influence of these psychoactive plants, beings that are not just a creation of your imagination, but are real, that exist in some other realm. Thoughts?
Well, I agree with him, and I think that, number one, that's true on face value, and also in my experience when I have a long and checkered history with substances and psychoactive substances, not all for the good, and I had some bad trips, and in one of those bad trips, I did encounter demonic entities, and they warned me in very clear, unmistakable terms that if I took this concoction again, they would not let me go next time. So I took that to heart, and I listened to them, and I have not combined those elements in that way. I took the alchemist's advice and have no desire to go back to that place. But I think, you know, cultivated as a science and a methodology with the right people and with the right set of intentions, the potential for transformation and for unlocking dimensions of our mind and exploring the inner cosmos, I think it's a really important point, because the cosmos is as big on the inside as it is on the outside. And as much as we look out of telescopes at the distant reaches of the birth of the galaxy, we can do that with our own interior experience. And I think psychoactive compounds used wisely from with wise people could be amazing. They're not part of my practice right now, and they probably won't be again in the future. I'm sticking to the mundane meditation stuff that's slow and boring. But I certainly don't rule them out. And, you know, for the right people in the right circumstances, which is a very particular combination, I would endorse them.
Well, Stuart, I agree with you, and I've sort of reached the same place that, you know, dealing with aliens or visitors or the others, whatever you want to call it, it's much more about the nature of reality, big picture stuff, than it is about weekend trips to Earth by our nearby neighbors. Really enjoyed the conversation and enjoyed your music. I hope you'll come back and join us again sometime.
Hey, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
All right. We'll talk to you again. Stuart Davis, check out his music. We've got links on our website. Also, my thanks to Dr. Stephen Bax, who is helping to crack the code of the Voynich manuscript, and my earlier guests, Dennis McKenna and Suzanne Taylor. Thanks to my friends and colleagues there at Premier, Nathan Staton, Gina Salvati, our webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galati, and producer Chris Boros. I'll be back next Sunday as well as next Saturday, both programs next week. Hope you can tune in then. Good night, everyone.